From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Laura Weber Davis, in for April Baer. Today on the program, COVID news in Michigan has been hard to keep up with.
We're already seeing an increase of 282 cases and 23 deaths from yesterday. So it's really alarming to see what's happening in Detroit, but it's also encouraging to see officials take this serious.
We'll talk to a couple reporters on top of the big stories, plus a look at how extreme wealth in the city of Detroit could shape the region's future.
Cities and wealth go hand in hand. It's a complicated partnership, but it's very much part of the way that cities evolve.
And we'll talk about how to cope with uncertainty and isolation in these strange times.
And so I think that we are now being forced to sit with ourselves in that way because we have to, not out of choice.
Those stories and more. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Laura Weber Davis, sitting in for April Baer. Later on the program, we'll check in with writer Desiree Cooper. She's been living with and caring for her parents, both of whom suffer from Alzheimer's. We'll talk to her about coping with uncertainty.
I have been social distanced for several years now.
That's later on the show. But first, a field hospital, Party Zero in Detroit, and the death of a lawmaker. Trying to keep track of the coronavirus-related news in Michigan is, as one of my next guests often says, like trying to drink from a fire hose. Here to help me take it all in is Kat Stafford, a Detroit-based reporter with the Associated Press, and Zach Gorchow, publisher of Gongwer News Service in Lansing. Guys, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Great to be here.
Let's start in Detroit. Kat, most of the big pieces of news that we've seen over the past couple days have come out of the city of Detroit as it's quickly becoming one of the epicenters of the spread of this virus nationally. I guess I was surprised, maybe I shouldn't have been, to hear that the TCF Center, formerly known as the Cobo Center, is going to be the site of a field hospital, and that the auto show that was now going to be in June is now not going to happen this summer. So tell me a little bit about whether or not that surprised you and how that materialized.
Well, I think a lot of people were surprised, but if you look at what's happening in other states across the country, you know, just taking a look at New York and how they're turning Central Park into one of these field hospitals, I guess we shouldn't be all that surprised. And what officials are saying are, you know, they hope that we don't get to the point where we have to use this 900 plus bed field hospital, but it's better to be safe than sorry. We're already seeing an increase of 282 cases and 23 deaths from yesterday. So it's really alarming to see what's happening in Detroit, but it's also encouraging to see officials take this serious.
Zach, the governor put out a call after this was announced that she was looking for nurses and doctors to work at the field hospital. How does that happen? What takes place to get people to apply or to work in this field hospital?
I mean, like so much of this, this is just unprecedented kinds of stuff. You know, they're trying to summon retired doctors and nurses. They're trying to free up health professionals who may not be medical doctors. Maybe they're physician's assistants. Maybe instead of being an anesthesiologist, they're a certified registered nurse anesthetist. And they're basically trying to free up anybody with a credential that involves medicine to get involved. You know, a lot of these folks, like a physician assistant, they can only practice under the supervision of a physician. And, I mean, that the governor temporarily suspended what are called scope of practice laws is extraordinary. I mean, you think about how bitter the fights have been over the years in the Capitol about who gets to practice what kind of medicine. And now, you know, at least until the state of emergency ends, it's over. So they're trying to set up websites, portals, and just issuing, you know, an all-hands-on-deck call. I think that's part of why the governor has been on television so much in on so many different shows, is she's trying to reach everybody she can to get anybody who can possibly help to help.
I want to turn to another story. It seems that each of our states in the nation have had what we have deemed Party Zero, a place where multiple cases of COVID-19 have emerged. And out of the city of Detroit, it was a breakfast called Police and Pancakes. This ended up being an event where we saw lots of positive diagnoses for the police department, as well as a young entrepreneur who lost his life, Marlo Stoudemire. Kat, tell me a little bit more about Police and Pancakes and what we know about who came out of that ill.
So this was a community event, and kudos to the Detroit Free Press for really kind of detailing what happened with this. But from my understanding, this happened on March 6th, and this was an event that was attended by several police officers, high school students, community leaders. And this was really one of those events that the police department and other people try to do just to really support the community, just a feel-good event. But what we saw come of that is actual, like you said, several police officers who became sick. And within the 9th precinct, this was one of the hardest hit precincts in terms of the police department. 46 people were quarantined. So it's really concerning when you think about the police department and think about how crucial these first responders are in terms of keeping the community safe and just keeping us afloat. And I just want to point out, especially with the 9th precinct, historically, that's been one of the areas of the city that has a large volume of police calls and needs a lot of police responses. So a lot of people are concerned, well, are our police officers okay? And the mayor, Mike Duggan, has been doing a pretty good job of keeping the community updated in terms of quarantines. But as you saw, even the police chief, James Craig, tested positive for coronavirus. And the homicide leader of the homicide department just died from it. So it's really concerning and just really sad to see how it's really devastated all corners of the city.
Zach, has there been any discussion at the state capitol or anyone you've talked to about what the state would do or what a city would do if a whole department was deemed ill or needed to be quarantined because of this virus? How a city or a township might react, or whether the state would be able to step in?
I haven't heard any discussions along those lines, but look, you've got the Michigan State Police. There's a force there of about 2,000 troopers, and there's no question that the state, if it needed to, if you had a situation where an unacceptably large number of police officers were sickened or quarantined or could not, for whatever reason, perform the duties, that the state could definitely step in and send state troopers to help and make up for that. I mean, that's certainly one option. Another possibility, the governor has been very, very adamant about that the Michigan National Guard is only being used for humanitarian purposes because, she doesn't want it to look like this is some sort of military-style thing. I mean, people are scared enough as it is. But if need be, there is the National Guard that would be available to help, too. So there's a lot of resources the state could summon. And the state has a lot of powers here to allocate resources. And remember, local governments are creatures of the state. And if there are communities out there that have no problems whatsoever and their officers really don't have a lot to do, believe me, the state will find ways to reallocate officers to the areas that are in need.
So, Zach, I wanted to turn finally to one of the more upsetting stories in the past few days. As we've seen, many people lose their lives. One of those people was a 43-year-old state lawmaker named Isaac Robinson, son of another former legislator from the city of Detroit, and just blindsided even his family in his very untimely and very quick death. Will you tell me a little bit more about Isaac?
Yes, a terrible tragedy. He's a first-term state rep at the Capitol, but sometimes people in the legislature they get defined by their title or they're notable because of their title. But really, I mean, Isaac Robinson was a champion of the union movement. I mean, that's really what he spent most of his life dedicated to. He was with the Teamsters for a number of years. He's also an attorney. And has been a political operative helping Democrats get elected for many, many years, and getting elected to the legislature himself was sort of the capstone of that. He's been in the slightly over a year that he was a member, a real rabble-rouser in many ways, leading protests when there was resistance to the plan to close Benton Harbor High School. It was Isaac Robinson, a state representative from Detroit, who was really helping galvanize reaction in Lansing. He really marched to his own beat. There was a lot of love for him because he really worked hard to get a lot help to get a lot of people elected. And, you know, unlike a lot of politicians who are very polished, you know, Isaac, like I said, he marched his own beat. He, you know, I was once at a campaign event when Ken Cockrell Jr. was running for mayor, where he sort of ad-libbed a Ken Cockrell theme song on the spot, and it was, you know, really kind of adorable, even though, you know, his singing voice wasn't great, but it was kind of great just to listen to. So he was, like I said, a unique character, and a lot of people are really upset.
Kat, I saw an outpouring of sympathy and support and shock, I guess, the amalgamation of feelings that were coming out of people from the city of Detroit. I mean, he hadn't been in office very long, but he'd clearly made a deep impact on a lot of Detroiters.
Yeah, and so this past week, I spent a lot of time working on a story about water shutoffs across the nation and spoke with a lot of community activists on the ground. And when I asked them, who should I talk to about this? They said, Isaac Robinson. He was very passionate about issues that directly impacted people in his district, that impacted the entire city, to be frank. And he fought to impose a moratorium on evictions, foreclosures, to stop water and other utility shutoffs. And he also was very passionate about a lot of these environmental issues that you have seen over the past several years pop up in the city of Detroit. So he was really one of those politicians that you actually saw on the front line. Like Zach said, you would see him at a lot of these D Fight for 15 movements to get workers higher wages. So when you talk about the city and the impact that his death has for a lot of people, they feel like they really lost a community champion.
Kat Stafford is a Detroit-based reporter with the Associated Press, and Zach Gorchow is publisher of Gong War News. Thank you both so much for catching me up.
Thank you.
Coming up, we'll look at how extreme wealth in the city of Detroit crafts how the city will look into the future.
10 years ago, the largest employers in the city of Detroit were General Motors, the public schools, the city, and the state. Today, the largest employer in the city of Detroit is Gilbert and his family.
That's next on Stateside. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Laura Weber-Davis, in for April Baer. Detroit has several billionaires who influence the way the city looks and feels. Among them, Martha Ford, who married into the Ford Motor Company family and is owner of the Detroit Lions. Maddie Maroon, who owns the Ambassador Bridge and recently sold the old train station in Detroit to Ford. The Illiches, who own the Detroit Tigers and the Red Wings and Motor City Casino and, of course, Little Caesars Pizza. And then there's Dan Gilbert, a newer but phenomenally important name in the landscape of billionaires who invest in the city. He founded Quicken Loans and has since transformed the core of Detroit's downtown. This group of people has profound reach in the city. They pour out into the community with their philanthropic investment, and they stretch up into the sky with ownership of some of Detroit's most significant buildings and infrastructure. So how does a city balance the needs of its investors with the needs of its communities, especially when those needs might be at cross purposes? Here to help me unpack the influence of the very wealthy on the city of Detroit is Brandon Snyder, Executive Director of Detroit Action. Brandon, welcome.
Thank you for having us.
And we have Robin Boyle. He's a retired professor of urban planning at Wayne State University. Robin, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much, Jen. Good afternoon.
So let's start with you, Robin. How do the super wealthy factor into Detroit's modern development strategy?
Well, like any other city on the globe, billionaires like to play in this particular sandcastle. Just think of Monopoly. When you go and play the game, you're after the big bucks and you're after the big property. Cities and wealth go hand in hand. It's a complicated partnership, but it's very much part of the way that cities evolved, particularly in the last 150 years or so. Since about the 1860s, we've seen significant agglomeration of capital focusing on cities where they see, the billionaires, the wealthy, see opportunity to expand their wealth. It goes very much with the territory. Here in Detroit, you've identified a number of billionaires that are active in cities. That is not unfamiliar. Around the world, around the rest of the United States, the billionaires have a very important part to play. What makes Detroit distinctive, and something I'm sure we will come back to discuss, is the extent to which really two, maybe three, maybe four, if you stretch it, players who do command rankings on the Forbes list of the wealthiest people in the nation have had a huge impact in the past, decade? I mean, it's that short a time.
Well, let's talk, Brandon, about where we see tangible investment, things that we can see with our eyeballs. I'm thinking of the Q Line, of course, through Dan Gilbert's Bedrock, LCA and the District Detroit with the Illiches. Let's talk about how they've changed the visual landscape.
Yeah, you know, I guess in the last 10 years or so, you know, maybe even shorter than that, the last 8 years, you know, we've seen this massive change in this landscape of downtown from, some of those landmarks that you've mentioned. And, you know, what's happened is that, you know, in addition to one of the things that Robin has mentioned, is that this massive, changing or a massive accumulation of capital, you know, we've also seen a massive accumulation of power, be it political power and be it, economic power from those who've developed downtown. Dan Gilbert, who you mentioned, is a property owner of some 80 some properties downtown. And this has happened just within the last 8 years, where if you were to post housing bubble, post bankruptcy of the city of Detroit. So I think that when we look at, the role of billionaires, and we look at, how the influence that they've made in downtown, you can't sort of separate the amassing of capital and the amassing of property with the accumulation of political power.
Well, I want to talk about the benefits and concerns that we're dealing with here. Let's start with the benefits. Robin, what are some of the benefits that we have when we have billionaires investing in cities?
Well, the obvious benefit and one that I would say Dan Gilbert and his family of companies have provided are jobs. Let me just give you one specific example. 10 years ago, the largest employers in the city of Detroit, and I mean the 139 square miles, the largest employers were, and this is not in any particular order, General Motors, the public schools, the city, and the state. Today, the largest employer in the city of Detroit is Gilbert and his families. Around 18,000 people are employed, much more than any of the previous employers that I have just mentioned. Because the car industry, as you know, has been in decline. Ford is not headquartered here. FAC is outside, and they don't have a great deal of construction. So, first and foremost, large-scale investment, whether they're millionaires or mere, if they're billionaires or mere
millionaires.
mere millionaires.
Right.
The most important impact in the short term is the fact that they bring jobs into the city. And in that downtown area, that 7.2, that little area that we talk about as downtown, these jobs have made an incredible difference.
But I would say that out of that, then the concern is probably who they're employing. Am I right, Brandon?
Yeah, absolutely. I think one of the things that you look at when you talk about the jobs that are people that have been employed by the Bedrock family of businesses is that many of those jobs, came from downtown, came from the suburbs and were relocated downtown. Many of the folks who are employed are, traditionally much more wealthier, much more college educated, much more white than the city as a whole. And what we see is that, people that like we represent, folks who are, native Detroiters, people who are black and brown, people who, are lower income, many of the folks, specifically people who have felony backgrounds, aren't employed into the Bedrock family of businesses. And so what we have is, while we have this development and this creation of jobs, what we have is, this development that's sort of unequal and tenuous at best.
Well, let me push back on
please,
that a little bit.
Please.
If I could, I think Brandon is correct. the majority of full-time employees who are coming in under the banner of the billionaires tend to be either people who have come in from the jobs in the suburbs, because he moved his company in 2010 from Livonia, or they are newcomers who have come into the city filling the positions in some of these quite unusual jobs, StockX, for example, who are attracting people from around the country. But let me push back a bit. If you go down into Campus Martius today and look at what happens at lunchtime, you see thousands of young African-Americans pouring out of these buildings. Why? Because Dan Gilbert has one of the largest internship programs in the country, dedicated to bringing jobs to young kids for the summer. Now you say, okay, it's an internship. Does it add up to something? Well, hell yes, it does. It adds up to people giving a chance to get a job in a downtown firm, a chance to perhaps see the opportunities, perhaps to give them a motive, whether you're black, white, or indifferent, to stay in school, to finish, and to become one of these employees downtown. So while I agree with the fact that a lot of the folks filling the buildings 365 days a year tend to be white, this impact in the summer and the internship programs is not to be dismissed. I think Gilbert has committed to that and has done it now for something like 5 years.
Yeah, but if I may, I think that the internship program represents just a small minority of the whole employees who are at the Bedrock family of businesses. Yes. What you see is, you know, for people who are, you know, black and who are employed and who are a lower income, many of these people make up the positions that are, you know, your people who are in the kitchens, people who are the janitors, people who are the security guards. And what we end up seeing is that, you know, the businesses that employ those folks who are employed by those buildings, you know, don't pay their folks a living wage. So we end up having, again, you know, a really tenuous process of job creation where we're giving away taxes and benefits to corporations who ultimately, you know, trickle down, you know, low paying jobs for local Detroiters. And I think that's one of the things that we look at when we talk about development that's very unequal, you know, very unfair to the folks who are ultimately paying for this development to occur.
If you're just joining us now, I'm Laura Weber-Davis, and joining me is Brandon Snyder. He's Executive Director of Detroit Action, and Robin Boyle, Professor of Urban Planning, recently retired from Wayne State University. If we can continue on this line a bit, I'm curious, when you have very few wealthy white people making decisions for a city that is populated by hundreds of thousands of black people, and particularly in a city that has a poverty rate that it's as high as it is, are there ways that these investors and the city can be avoiding turning that unbalance into further racial inequity?
I mean, I think one of the easiest ways is, you know, the community benefits agreement process. You know, I think that is a process that
if we can just recap that quickly for our listeners, the community benefits agreement would ostensibly require investors to hire a certain number of Detroiters and locals for their projects.
I think that's one of the processes, but there's also many other agreements that come with community benefits. You know, when the Pistons moved to Detroit and Henry Ford Hospital was being developed, one of the things that they created as an externality was, you know, that we would create basketball hoops and fix up local parks. So there are a number of ways that corporations can work with communities, you know, if they're going to receive tax benefits and tax breaks to move and to develop. One of the things that we believe, you know, is important if, you know, for corporations like the Bedrock family to, you know, if they're going to move to town is, again, to hire folks who, you know, who are from our community and, you know, to work around historic preservation. So groups like Detroit People's Platform, groups like ours, and other community groups have really been pushing to make sure that, you know, the Bedrock family of companies, Chrysler, as well as other folks who are moving into town, you know, really work with surrounding neighborhoods to ensure that the quality of life doesn't change dramatically, but also that people who are in the city are able to be employed because of this changing in development. And I think that's one of the things that we're most interested in when we talk about development for downtown, is that, you know, yearly we have about 5,000 Detroiters who come home from prison throughout the state to Wayne County, and zero of those folks can actually get employed from the Bedrock families.
I mean, I think I agree with almost everything that's been said, and it is important that when companies, particularly companies that get state or local incentives, there needs to be, and in the case of the city of Detroit, there is a requirement that employment is dedicated towards those who live in the city of Detroit. There's a problem. And we know what the problem is, and this is what the pushback is from so many of the companies, is that the skill levels are not there because the building trades, the construction trades, the welders, the scaffolders, the millwright workers, etc., are people who come out of skilled trades. Many of the folks in big cities, not least Detroit, lack these skills. So there has to be a similar public policy platform built to actually improve the training opportunities that there are in the city. And we failed to do that over the years. We simply failed to do it. So now the companies can turn around and say, but we can't get people who work with stone. We can't get people who work with wood. We can't get people who work with steel. We have to go outside. And it's very hard to argue against that if you don't have a pool of skilled trades in the city.
But should the wealthiest investors in the city of Detroit be required to be on the hook for some of that training?
Yes, absolutely. That is what they should be doing. They should be investing in this world. We have reduced the capacity of the public sector in so many fields, not least in skilled trades training, that it is behooven to these companies to step up and be much, much more involved in supporting and working directly with community colleges, with other organizations to build a much deeper, much thicker layer of skilled folks who live and work in the city of Detroit.
Agreed. And I think the other thing that to add to that is that many of the labor unions who service these properties or are hired to develop these properties are people who, you know, oftentimes invest in that sort of skills development and skills training, especially at IBEW and other folks who are labor unions here. One of the things that I think that's important to note is that, you know, by investing and allowing people to be a part of unions, be a part of the and be a part of the labor force, you know, there is an opportunity to develop skills, but also an opportunity to reduce turnover, because people who are part of unions, people who are part of who are well trained by unions, you know, often stick with the job and often are able to accomplish that job much more effectively.
Robin, I'm curious if Detroit is in some ways particularly vulnerable to being molded by a few moneyed parties because Detroit has sort of seen this surge in recent years and has seen a lot of devastation over the past 50, 60 years.
Yes and no. I think, let me answer that in a slightly complicated way, and I'll try and keep it quick. A few months ago, I used a social media platform that I'm involved with through work to ask a similar question. To what extent has your city — these are our colleagues who work across the United States of America and Canada — to what extent in your city can you identify the proportion of development occurring similar to that in Detroit? In other words, are you being dominated by particularly very wealthy individuals? And with really just one exception, maybe two, no other place was demonstrating the same sort of impact that the one family, in this case, of course, Dan Gilbert and his range of companies, was having. The other place was Durham, North Carolina, funnily enough. And the other one, and it's a bit of a stretch, is in the Northwest, where in Seattle, there's been incredible investment by a relatively small number of very, very wealthy people coming out, of course, of the high-tech economy. So yes, in answer to your question, I think a place like Detroit is to some extent vulnerable. But on the other hand, that vulnerability was caused by the exodus of wealth. That vulnerability was caused by those who did own property, who did nothing, sat on their properties, not investing in them, letting them fall apart, or worse still, getting knocked down and becoming car parks, that there was an opportunity for an individual like Gilbert to come in and buy properties at 15 cents on the dollar and then become this really, really large real estate owner here in the city of Detroit. And that then in itself leads, of course, to the problems and the concerns that perhaps we've already discussed.
That was Robin Boyle, a retired professor of urban planning at Wayne State University. We also were speaking with Brandon Snyder, executive director of Good Jobs Now. If you've been listening to Stateside for the past couple weeks, you may have heard us mention our Michigan March Movie Madness Tournament. To fill the bracket-shaped hole in our hearts this month, we pitted 16 movies set in, filmed in, or about Michigan against each other. Our goal? find the most quintessentially Michigan movie of them all. And if you've been listening closely, you'll know that this was not exactly a contest for me. I not so subtly made the argument that 8 Mile is the most Michigan movie and should be victorious. And now we've got a winner. That's right, 8 Mile, the 2002 film starring Warren's own Marshall Mathers, a.k.a. rapper Eminem. 8 Mile has been crowned the most quintessentially Michigan movie by our Instagram followers. I may be terrible at basketball brackets, but I'm happy to say that I had this one pegged. This movie is Michigan through and through. It stars one of Detroit's most famous rappers. It was filmed in the city. It features Detroit's famous R&B radio station. Many of the battle rappers and extras were cast in Detroit. Some of the characters work in auto plants, and its title references the famous street on Detroit's border. Need I say more? Yes, I am satisfied. And I hope you are too. So thanks for playing along on our Instagram page if you did. And if you didn't, you can check out all 16 movies and how they fared on our Michigan March Movie Madness Tournament at michiganradio.org. Just click on the stateside tab. Coming up, we'll talk to author Desiree Cooper about coping with uncertainty in troubling times. Stick with us. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Laura Weber Davis, in for April Baer. During periods of uncertainty, we often turn to historical figures or those who we know for guidance or for inspiration. It's true for me as well. And one of the first people I think of is writer Desiree Cooper. I have known her for several years when she and I both worked in Detroit, and then life took us both away from the city. Now Desiree lives in Virginia Beach, and she's caring for her elderly parents, both of whom suffer from Alzheimer's. So with us now from Virginia is Desiree. Desiree, welcome.
Oh, thanks for having me. Everything is virtual now, so I feel like this is the way I'm connecting with everyone, long distance but intimate at the same time.
Right, exactly. We are making do. So how are you making do? How is your family?
Okay, well, first of all, I have been social distanced for several years now because taking care of two parents, I often can't leave the house unless there's someone to tag team.
Yeah.
And I haven't had a lot of support in place until recently. And now that support can't come over. So I'm kind of back to square one.
Yeah.
But I've sort of learned how to do this. And the other thing, it's totally unfair to brag to your Michigan listeners, but in the Virginia Beach area, like, spring actually comes at springtime.
Ugh.
So we've had a number of days, 75 and higher. So I can sit in the sun. I can start to garden. You know, those things that kind of make you feel human again.
Yes. Absorb some vitamin D.
Yes.
Have you tried to talk to your parents about the outbreak, or has that not been something you've tried to tackle in discussing with them?
My dad has been forever a 24-hour news cycle junkie. Hmm. He's CNN. And so even now, as the news is more dire and more complicated, he really wants to sit in front of it and watch it. My mother is not absorbing any of this.
Yeah.
But it has taken a while for the impact to really sink in. And our biggest impact is that my grandchildren live nearby, their great-grandchildren. And he's starting asking, like, where are they? And are they coming over? And who's sick? And who's okay? And he's not thinking about the virus. He's just noticing that time is now, you know, drifting away and he's not seeing them anymore.
So your grandkids have been staying away and self-isolating as well?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. You know, you said on this program that being with your parents and caring for your parents has slapped the type A out of you, which, you know, was just both funny and sad to me at the same time. But in many ways, you know, you often post on social media about caring for your grandchildren as well. And children require, and especially the ages, the young ages they are, require a lot of structure. And type A can be very beneficial for them when it comes to guidance.
Mm-hmm.
How do you balance those two sides of yourself, not only being daughter and grandmother, but both having to reject the type A aspects when caring for your parents, but also embrace them when caring for your grandchildren?
So I think that I'm in a place that many people are kind of just starting. And that is, what would happen if you woke up one day and everything you thought was super important did not give an iota of matter, you know, like did not matter at all.
Yeah.
And so I think that we are now being forced to sit with ourselves in that way, because we have to, not out of choice. And so I'm doubling back to your answer. The type A has been slapped out of me like 500 times over now. You know, what I had left of it has now been eroded by the virus. And so what I am doing is letting things happen. For my kids, and my grandkids, I was always very focused on ABCs, numbers, here's some flashcards, here's to see my house, it's a little school. And it was like that all the time. Mostly because that's how I was raised, and I'm type A. But now when they come over, it's like we use the Play-Doh and make pretend food. We reinvent Chopped, like, you know, they have to present interesting combinations of food. And I tell myself, this too is very important learning.
Right.
So instead of trying to teach new vocabulary words or whatever, let's teach them those soft, and what we're learning now are the hard survival skills.
Mm-hmm. So you're saying that parents the nation over should not feel bad if they aren't implementing their flashcards every single day?
Why would you do that? You know, see, this gets to the Alzheimer's conversation. If my dad in the moment thinks that my name is Betty and that I went to high school with him, then my job is not to pound it on him that I'm his dutiful daughter who he ought to recognize. My job in that moment is to say, remember when we went to that dance? And let him talk about that.
Hmm.
You know, so we should do the same thing with the kids. I mean, aren't they grieving and mourning enough that they're not seeing their friends, they're cooped up, than to have you now impose the structure that really could add not only more stress on them, but on you? Do you have the bandwidth to do that now? Really?
When did you know that you needed to move in with your parents and be with your parents full time?
When I knew it and when I did it are probably a year and a half apart.
Hmm.
And it's kind of back to what you were saying. I was in a life that I was terrified for my parents, and I knew things were getting hard. I do have a sibling here in the Virginia Beach area. He's an architect, a partner in a firm. He wasn't going to leave his job to come and give medicines every day or whatever, but he was here if anything happened, and he came every single weekend.
Yeah.
So I was living my very important life thinking, how can I drop my very important life? I can't do that. It's impossible. I have to make money. I have my own career goals. People need me direly at work. And I don't know if you're aware of this, but I was in a car accident and I had a traumatic brain injury and I couldn't immediately go back to work.
Hmm.
And this was my coronavirus back then. It's the thing that said, well, actually, you can stop working. And guess what? The company went on. I still have some resources to live very humbly. And I magically had all the time in the world to come and take care of my parents.
Desiree, do you have time, or do you give yourself, do you allow yourself the negative space to think about what would happen if your parents got sick or if you got sick as their caretaker?
Yeah, this is going to sound horrible, but one reason I'm social distancing from my daughter's family and my grandchildren is because I said to my daughter, I don't want to be in a hospital somewhere wondering which one of us killed my parents.
Mm-hmm. That's exactly the conversation I had to have with my parents as well. You know, I mean, they just live a couple blocks away from me and we won't go see them for a while because I don't want to see my parents get sick and wonder if it was me or my children.
Right. Right. It's horrible. I mean, I have a friend in Syracuse, New York that gave birth to her second daughter yesterday. You know, the hospital let her husband come in, but her parents, she lives in Syracuse. Her parents are in Arizona. And one parent traveled to come be by her side. And I thought immediately, oh, no, you're not going through the airports and everything and a new baby, you know. And then I thought, oh, my God, what if my daughter was giving birth right now? I would have to be there. I couldn't judge his choices, but only support him in hoping that, you know, everything's going to be fine. So we're all making very, very tough calculations, very tough choices. Detroiters have lived with threat a long time. And so there's always this calculation of, you know, is it imaginary? Is it real? Is it going to get me? Is it not? And why this threat? I mean, of poverty, of crime, of neglect, of, you know, all the none of the systems are really working. You are like, no one's going to come rescue me. That has been kind of like how the status quo has been for a long time. And so you'll hear Detroiters say, you know, what are you talking about? Come on downtown, it's safe. And you hear people outside of that city saying, oh, no, I never go, it's not safe. Well, I mean, there's a calculation of what is really a threat and what isn't, and what you're willing to tolerate, how much risk you're willing to tolerate. And people have to weigh that and sort through what is real and what is imagined. And then also what is real and imagined for yourself and your family. Is it more worth it for you to spend the last days of a terminally ill person in person with them? Or would you separate from them to make sure no one else got sick or you didn't make them sicker and let them die alone? Like, that's hard. And I can't begrudge anyone who makes the choice one way or the other. So I want to read you a poem. Can I do that?
Oh, please. Yes.
Okay. So this is a poem by Derek Alton Walcott. And he was born in St. Lucia. He's a Caribbean poet. And he received a Nobel Prize in Literature in the early 90s. And this is my favorite poem by him. I used to keep it on my mirror in my bedroom. And it's called Love After Love. The time will come when, with elation, you will greet yourself arriving at your own door, in your own mirror. And each will smile at the other's welcome and say, sit here, eat. You will love again the stranger who was yourself. Give wine, give bread, give back your heart to itself, to the stranger who has loved you all your life, whom you ignored for another, who knows you by heart. Take down the love letters from the bookshelf, the photographs, the desperate notes. Peel your own image from the mirror. Sit, feast on your life.
That was beautiful, Desiree. Thank you for picking that one.
Well, it says to me that, you know, there's a lot of woe outside our doors. And a lot of us are grieving a lot of things. The real loss of people that we've loved, and the loss of the life we used to have, and the loss of the dreams we thought were on track. I mean, I just feel so sad for the college graduate or high school graduates, the proms, the, you know, the things that were once in a lifetime things that aren't going to happen now. But this poem says to me that there's an inside self that's been waiting to be met, you know, for you to come back to. And if there is a way to cope with this, then maybe that's the way to look at it, that there's a new person for you to meet, and that's yourself. And let's get to know that person and treat that person as well as you can.
Desiree Cooper is a Detroit writer, now based out of Virginia Beach, living with her parents there. Desiree, this is the connection I needed today, so thank you.
Same here. It's so good to talk to you. You be safe.
It's now been 3 weeks since Governor Gretchen Whitmer announced the first positive coronavirus test in Michigan. People want to know how long schools will remain closed. Will Michigan get the needed masks and other medical supplies? Do we have enough healthcare workers? Michigan Radio's Capitol Bureau Chief Rick Pluta spoke today with the governor.
Governor, where are we today?
Well, you know, today we are continuing to work to get PPE for our nurses and doctors. Working to get facilities set up at TCF in downtown Detroit so that we've got beds for COVID-19 patients. We are continuing to finalize our plans with regard to education. So we're always in a continuous state of activity and stakeholder information sharing and making sure that as we craft kind of our policy response to COVID-19, we're getting the most accurate information we can, anticipating needs and building out plans, not just in the immediate crisis, but with an eye toward, you know, what's next.
And what kinds of things are you looking at? What are the questions that need to be answered?
Well, we need to really, I mean, all of the modeling is changing as we get more testing done. We've got a lot more that we should be doing, and that's why we're continuing to try to work with companies that are making the test kits to ensure Michigan gets more, to working with the federal government on that front as well, to having leaders coming together to talk through and assess what are the things that we need to see. When is the flattening of the curve? What are the data points that we need to be looking at so that we make responsible decisions about what life might look like in terms of ramping back up again? But at this juncture, we are still on the dramatic upswing of COVID-19 in our state. We have another 1,000, over 1,000 people test positive in the last 24 hours. We know we will continue to see that number climb. We had 52 people die between 3 o'clock yesterday afternoon and the 24-hour period leading up to it. So we are still in the dramatic upswing here. We know that we don't have enough masks. We don't have enough gloves or gowns or face shields for all of our providers on the front line, and so we're continuing on that. And at some point, which data points really tell us where we've started to flatten the curve, where we see the aggressive measures helping us to give relief to our healthcare system and our healthcare providers, and what are the needs of our kids, our families, and our businesses going to be at when we get to that point.
So we know that we don't have enough doctors, RNs, specialists, but where, as specifically as you can let us know, do we stand in terms of the healthcare workers that we need?
When this number of patients, COVID patients, continues to grow as exponentially as it is, it's hard to tell you exactly the number of respiratory therapists and nurses and doctors that we need. But what I can tell you with complete confidence is we don't have enough. And the same goes for the PPE. I was on the phone yesterday with a number of the CEOs of the hospital systems in Southeast Michigan. They were voicing concern about making sure that our border stays open to healthcare workers, because we have a lot of Canadian healthcare workers that come in and take care of Michiganders in Southeast Michigan in particular. We know that it would be incredibly hard on our ability to meet need just on a regular day if that was shut down, much less in these days. So this is just one of many factors that we are confronting, and that's why we are just pulling out all the stops to get all hands on deck and procure every item we can in every fashion that we can.
Governor, what is going to happen with schools in the school year?
Well, Rick, we are finalizing our plan. We've had a lot of conversation with our experts on the front line, the educators and administrators across the state. We've been engaging with the Michigan Department of Education as well as the legislature to make sure that we have a comprehensive, thought-out plan to meet the needs of our students. We have 1.5 million students in Michigan schools, and there are very different needs in different parts of our state and different resources available, and that's why it's not just something that we can craft overnight. It's got to be thoughtful. It's got to be comprehensive. And so I would anticipate being able to give you more detail in the coming days.
Can we expect anything today?
No.
Governor Gretchen Whitmer, thank you so much.
Thank you, Rick.
That was Michigan Radio's Capitol Bureau Chief Rick Pluta speaking with Governor Whitmer. I'm Laura Weber Davis. Thanks so much for joining us today. We'll see you tomorrow.